Hey, I'm CJ, a millennial. You may know me from the podcast Science with Millennials. Well, you'd be correct, but this time we're coming at you with something other than science. We're going to be utilizing Rachel's forensic science degree and my psych knowledge to bring you a podcast that will be both thrilling and chilling.
If you haven't guessed from the title, we're going to be talking about true crime. I absolutely love learning about different true crime cases and have a plethora of knowledge pent up in my brain about cases I've read about, listened to, and watched on TV. So we're going to be utilizing my forensic chemistry degree as well as CJ's psych knowledge. As a reminder, CJ doesn't know what the case is before recording the episodes, so it's a mystery for you and her. Let's open today's case file and see what's in store. Welcome to True Crime with Millennials. I'm ready to listen to a story today. Switching it up.
I almost dropped the microphone. Yeah, we're switching it up probably for this one only. But, you know. I have a case from Saginaw, Michigan. That took place in 1974. You ready to hear about it?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay. So Cheryl Miller was 21 years old, a college student, and was living with a roommate named Maxine in Saginaw, Michigan. She was known to be free-spirited and a loving person, and she was studying art and also worked in a bakery. She was popular and had her own motorcycle, which encouraged male attention, according to sources. I don't know why they felt the need to include that, but, you know, whatever. According to her aunt, she was also a caring and considerate person, as well as her aunt thinking of her as a perfect person, and having qualities that other people wish they had, a shining star. So we're, you know, she's the pretty popular girl that was popular around school and then had a roommate and stuff. And
she
Is
she in college then?
Go ahead. Yeah. Okay. She attends the local community college, or attended the local community college, Delta College.
Okay.
She had been dating a foreign exchange student, and I'm definitely going to pronounce his name wrong, and I am so sorry, but his name is Abbas Esafhani, I think, but they had broken up, so it prompted Cheryl to want to go out with some friends to get her minds off things, which she went with Maxine, who was her roommate. They went to a place called the Scene Bar, which was near a local college. You're near the local college, Delta College, which is where
was
she went
to like
school.
Was it like scene or like?
I have no idea.
Because if it was scene, that's my type of bar.
I doubt it, because it was in the 70s.
Oh yeah, it definitely wasn't scene then.
Apparently it caught on fire in 2016.
You love to see it. I feel like everything catches on fire. Like, that's just what things do.
Yeah. I don't know exactly. It says it was over. From what I'm seeing, it was over. It is now a restaurant called Sullivan's. But
oh, okay. I'm sure it wasn't, since it was from, like, the 70s, so.
Yeah, it's not, it wasn't Sullivan's then, but I think that's where it was. So she went to the Scene Bar, and she decided to leave early, and Maxine did not return to their apartment until 6 o'clock in the morning.
So they're really partying it up, huh?
Yes, absolutely.
I have never once in my life been like, man, I'm going to stay out till 6 a.m.
I mean, I have, but that's a totally different subject.
Maybe I'm just a bad, fun person.
Maybe I just have too much fun. You know, it could go either way. Anyway, when Maxine returned, she found Cheryl in their apartment on the floor in her bedroom, which it is notated that it looked like it was a violent struggle until she died, considering the amount of bruises and scars and scratches that she had on her body. There were also signs of forced entry into the apartment, which gave way to the idea of breaking and entering. One of the windows in the downstairs part of the apartment was open with the screen removed and the curtains were blowing out the window due to it being raining and windy outside.
So, what time what time of year did we say this was? Is it like cold, like where it'd be weird for her to have her window open?
I'm pretty sure it was in June.
Okay.
So, this was in June of 1974. Okay.
June 15th, 1974. So it would not be super weird for her to have her window open.
Oh, no. And it rains all the time in the summer in Michigan. Especially in Saginaw, because we're in a valley.
Okay.
But the curtains were blowing out the window due to it being rainy and windy outside. And the autopsy revealed that Cheryl had been sexually assaulted and strangled, and that she had died between the times of 5:30 a.m. to 6 a.m. that same morning. So just before Maxine got home. So literally,
right before she got home. Like,
right.
She probably... Like, that must be a horrifying situation where you're like, I'm glad I didn't get home a couple minutes earlier, but at the same time, like, maybe if I had gotten home a couple minutes earlier, this wouldn't have happened.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking, too. I was like, oh my god, like, that could have been... I mean, it's traumatic no matter what, but, like, she could have also gotten hurt.
Right.
The Saginaw police had reason to believe that they were looking for a sterile, dark-haired man, and that's because there was dark hair found on her, but no male specimen or semen was to be found on her even after the assault. So there was evidence of, like, sexual assault, but there wasn't any evidence of, like, you know. The first person of interest was her ex-boyfriend, of course, Abbas. He had dark hair and could have fit the profile. And there was also reasoning to believe he was the assailant because of Cheryl breaking up with him due to his temper, according to her parents. He had also been seen at the bar that Cheryl was last seen at, arguing with Cheryl about how he wanted to get back together, but they did not get back together. A week after Cheryl's death, Abbas went back to Iran, where he's from, because remember, he's a foreign exchange student, evading police questions, and also had left a week earlier than he was supposed to, even selling his car a few days after Cheryl was killed, and leaving a week early, like I said. He also left some belongings behind and never came back. So, this gave probable cause for a warrant to be issued, and Abbas was arrested in Iran, to which they also collected hair samples from him, but there was not 100% assurance that the hair they sent was actually his. There was hair taken from his hairbrush that he had left behind, and they requested the hair sample from Iran, but it did not match the hair that was taken from the hairbrush.
So, also, his finger- sorry, can I interrupt real quick? Yeah. So another thing that I just want to mention about, like, hair comparison is that it's not very accurate. Like...
Yeah, but this was the 70s, so...
Well, yeah, but, I mean, it's just a very, like... It's very much a... Oh, well, yeah, I mean, these look the same, but, like, who knows if they're actually from the same person. So when you're testifying hair evidence in court, you can never say this hair was from the person. You can say that this hair is consistent with the person or that it's not consistent.
I just wonder if they did, like, a DNA test on it or if it was just literally, oh, this is a dark hair and this is a dark hair.
Yeah, so when they say hair comparison, they're not doing DNA testing. They're literally looking at both under a microscope and are like, okay, yeah, they look similar. That's what they mean when they say hair comparison.
That's totally useless evidence.
I mean, it can rule people out, but it's not very good at ruling people in.
Yeah. They did also find his fingerprints on the railing that led up to Cheryl's bedroom.
Well, they were dating, so.
Yes, exactly. So, it makes sense that his fingerprints would be there.
Right. Especially if they had, like, just broken up.
Right, like, a week before that, they may not have cleaned it off or whatever. So, like, I don't know. My thoughts on him doing it are, like, well, let's hear more information, and then I'll tell you. He was one of 150 witnesses that they interviewed all the way to him living in Iran. And, like I said, the hair samples didn't match the ones they found in the apartment. So, with him being gone, it took the spotlight off of him, especially after the hair sample with the police, which made them turn to another person that Cheryl was close to, Maxine's cousin, who is, Maxine is her roommate, if you remember. His name was Antonio Alvarez, who had lived with them for a short time as well. The only thing that could tie him to the murder, though, was that he may fit the description of the physical appearance, so he was ruled out. He did live with them for a little bit, though. not very long, but just like, I don't know. They didn't say a certain amount of time, but I think I already said that. Then there was a discovery that Cheryl had been in a relationship with a different person, Gabriel Ferris, who was 27 at the time and came from a well-known family in Saginaw, Michigan. He had already been in trouble with the law for drug offenses, and they were in a relationship up until a week before Cheryl was killed.
So she was in a relationship with both guys at once?
Yep, she was potentially dating Abbas at the same time, or around the same time of dating Gabriel.
Okay.
Their relationship between Ferris and
Not that I'm Cheryl judging the victim or victim blaming at all or anything. I just wanted to clarify. Right.
Their relationship only ended because Ferris ended up getting married to another woman whose name is Terry, I guess.
That's always awkward when the guy you're dating marries someone else.
Yeah, but they had been together the whole time, and Ferris just had Cheryl on the side, which we'll get into in a little bit as well. His alibi was that he was almost 70 miles away on their honeymoon with Terry. And when they found the evidence of fingerprints on Cheryl's dresser in her bedroom, Ferris did not deny a sexual relationship with Cheryl, but it could not be determined that it was him, as he was not sterile and did not have dark hair.
I mean, it just sounds like, you know, they're slowly working through ruling out people. Did you say how she was killed?
Yeah, she was strangled and sexually assaulted.
So, yeah, I mean, strangulation's usually a crime of passion. Did they say whether it was manual strangulation or, like, ligature strangulation?
No, they didn't specify.
Okay. Because, I mean, like...
They did say that there was marks on her collarbones and... There was scratches and bruises on... There's bruises on her lips and then scratches on her face and neck.
Okay, so that sounds more like manual strangulation, which is definitely usually more of a personal crime where, like, they know the victim, but also not always, you know?
There wasn't a break in the case until 20 years later in the summer of 1994, which caused them to refocus on Ferris. Roy Walton was the Saginaw detective on the case, and even though the case was cold for 20 years, according to a coworker, he didn't lose hope and kept searching. This is because the reason they reopened it again was because Ferris's ex-wife, Terry, came forward and basically destroyed his alibi and said that there's conflicting statements that were given. They were told, or she told them that they were not on their honeymoon when she came forward. And I don't know why she took 20 years to say this, but then she turned around and said that she had told police that night that she was with Ferris all night and they went to bed at 10 p.m. and got up around 5 a.m., which Cheryl was killed sometime between 5:30 a.m. and 6 a.m. that day. But they were up.
That's still crazy, though, that she was killed right before the roommate got home. That almost makes me think it's more likely that it was somebody random, because if it was somebody that, like, knew her, they would know she had a roommate and that they'd be coming home eventually. Because, like, coming home from the bar is not something that's, like, scheduled. So, like, it's not like they know, oh, well, she has class right now and they're not going to be home. To me, that sounds almost like it's just somebody random who, you know, maybe she was sleeping with her window open or something, and then, like, somebody came in through the window and killed her or something.
Could be.
I don't know.
When there was the trial, she told them that Ferris returned to their cottage that was by Lake Huron with bloodstains on his clothes, and he had slammed the door when he walked in. For reference, Lake Huron is close to Saginaw, but it's still, like, maybe, depending on where you're going, because Lake Huron's huge, but it's at least half hour, 45 minute drive, depending on where you're at. Maybe a little bit longer than that.
And what time did he get back?
They didn't say what time he got back, but they did say that they got up around 5 a.m.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, if he... I mean, first of all, I'm sus about this woman coming forward 20 years later. I'm always sus about, like, witness testimony, because, like, everybody's got their own motivations for stuff. But it also sounds like if they got up around 5 a.m., like, he would have had to, like, leave immediately to be able to get to her house to kill her and then be gone before the roommate got home.
That's if Terry's telling the truth about the timing.
Right.
So when he got back, like I said, there's bloodstains on his clothes and he had slammed the door when he walked in. And Ferris had told Terry that the blood was because of hitting a rabbit that got stuck in the wheel well of his car, so he had to deal with it, hence the blood. She testified that same night to police saying the same thing I just told you, but also she said he got up real close to the television when it was talking about Cheryl Miller. He was touching the television and making noises like he was crying, but he wasn't crying. So I'm assuming that this is later in the day after they found out she was dead. He was pretend crying, according to her. He told me that was the last girlfriend he'd had before me. And then the questioner said, did he tell you that he was still dating her? And she said, no. Questioner said, did he tell you that he had a date with her the night before your wedding? And Terry said, no. So the prosecution claimed that this could be a motive behind the murder, that he had set up a date with Cheryl the night before him and Terry's wedding, like a bachelor party or a stag night situation. But it was more for him to have relations with her one more time before he got married. He told police, though, that his wife-to-be had kept a close eye on him, so close that he would not be able to get away to see Cheryl. So their thoughts moved to that he waited till the next opportune time, which would be the morning after the wedding.
I don't know. To me, this kind of just sounds like I'm assuming she's his ex-wife at the point that she comes forward with this. Yeah. It just kind of, to me, sounds like a woman who's just pissed off at her husband, her ex-husband. Like, I definitely would want more proof than just what this woman is saying.
Right. So the defense argued against the prosecution's words, saying that Ferris was not sterile and did not have dark hair, and that Cheryl was 65 miles away from where he was at, up by Lake Huron, and celebrating his marriage with his new wife. And said that there was an extreme lack of physical evidence, then turned the attention back towards Antonio, Maxine's cousin, and her ex-boyfriend, Abbas. They brought up the behavioral issues that Abbas had as well at the end of their relationship and him leaving earlier than planned. The prosecution turned it around on them and saying that they no longer believed that the killer was sterile and that there was just no semen found and that their hair, or that the hair may have come from her rug during the struggle of her murder.
See, this is the part that I hate about prosecutors, is that they will just turn the evidence to match whatever works best for them. Which, like, I get that that's their job, but also, like, you can't just make up stories to fit what you want to have happened.
Right. Like, exactly.
There's been other cases where, you know, like, the prosecution, like, tells their whole story and they're like, the murder happened at this time. And then the defendant says, oh, well, you know, I have a ironclad alibi for that time. And then the prosecution's like, well, you know, the murder could have then happened like 2 hours later. And I'm like, no, you can't just like make shit up on the spot to like fit what you want. To make it fit the suspect you want. Like, you're supposed to be following the evidence, not making the evidence fit your suspect.
Exactly. So here is some more, like, substantial evidence. The prosecution determined that the fingerprints, due to their positioning and where they were found, found that Gabriel, or I've been calling him Ferris, had murdered her because her body was found on the floor besides the dresser, and the fingerprints were just inches from her head. They claimed it was him because the fingerprints that were left could have been left by the murderer, which the fingerprints were left by Ferris.
The fingerprints were left by Ferris?
Yeah, like he left, or they're his fingerprints.
At her apartment?
Yeah, on the dresser, just inches from her head where she was laying dead.
But, I mean, I feel the same way about that as I do about the other boyfriend's fingerprints being found at her house. Mm-hmm. Like, and he just was there, like, 2 nights ago, right? Like, they had a date, like, a couple nights ago.
He tried to go to it.
What?
I think he tried to do that, but I don't think he was able to.
Oh, well, I mean, still, they had just broken up recently. So I feel like, you know, unless his fingerprints are, like, in blood or something, I don't feel like that's very damning evidence.
Ferris also has a past of harming women by choking them and physically harming them brutally, to which his ex-wife Terry had testified that he did that to her more than once as well, which, if you remember, Cheryl was strangled to death.
So is anybody else backing these claims up? Not that I'm trying to, like, say that she's lying or anything, or, like, say that she's not a victim. I'm just trying to, you know, get the full picture. Are other people saying that he also has strangled them, or, like, is there police reports to go with that or anything?
There was nothing that I could find from, you know, my limited resources, but Terry's just, like, the main person because, like I said, there was 150 witnesses that testified.
Oh my gosh.
I think her evidence was just the one that really stood out because she's the ex-wife.
I hate cases like that where, like, the entire evidence mm-hmm. is just...
I mean, not all of it is. I just haven't gotten to that part yet.
All right.
The assistant prosecutor had this to say about the case. He said, "This seems to be the classic love triangle. The supposition was that he left the honeymoon to go meet and make up with Cheryl. Did he go there intending to, I'm going to say sexually assault?" It says the R word, but that's triggering. So we're just going to go with sexually assault. Probably not. He may have gone there very well intending to have sex with her, and she said, "Look, you're married, I'm not having sex with you," and that angered him, and an argument ensued, and he ended up strangling her.
Yeah, I mean,
so after
it's not the, like, most conclusive, like, motive I've ever heard, but, like, people have definitely murdered for less, so.
Right. And after this, when his ex-wife destroyed his alibi in December of 94, so 20 years later, Saginaw police went down to Elgin, Illinois, where he was living. Ferris was living there. To interview him, where he was living with a roommate who was 10 years younger than him, age 35. His roommate said that after the police had left, that Ferris was a little irate and stuff and really irritable. And also mentioned that he was paranoid as well.
Was it, did it say whether his roommate was male or female?
I'm assuming male, but I'm not 100%
okay.
sure.
Also, I would like to just point out that if 20 years later the police came to try to, like, talk to me / accuse me of a murder, and I didn't do it, I'd probably be a little irate too. And also paranoid mm-hmm. because I know how badly the justice system can fuck people over.
Yep, that's what I was thinking too. It was after the murder that Ferris had moved to Elgin, Illinois, and it's unclear when he moved there from what I could find.
Also, like,
I know that was after the murder, though.
I hate when people are like, "Oh, well, he behaved in this way. That means that he did it." And I'm like, oh, he didn't grieve the right way, or, oh, he didn't respond the right way. And I'm like, you never know how other people are going to deal with their emotions. So, like,
right.
To me, that's never evidence when they're like, "Oh, well, he was acting sketchily after her death." And I'm like, okay, well, you know, Maybe that's how he's processing. I don't know.
He's also known for strangling and hurting women, so I don't think that he's, you know, a stand-up guy, and he's also gotten in trouble with drugs.
Right.
But after he moved to Elgin, he was unemployed and visited a homeless shelter frequently in Elgin, Illinois, where he was living, like in that city, and he would invite people over to his house from the homeless shelter and offer them somewhere to stay, but would take advantage of the people who he was inviting over by making them pay a lot of money for staying there and would also take their food stamps.
This is a really stupid question. Is Illinois next to Michigan, right?
So it's Michigan, then it's Ohio directly southeast, and then southwest is Indiana, and then to the west underneath, I think it's Wisconsin, is Illinois.
Okay.
Illinois kind of borders, like the tip of it kind of borders Lake Michigan.
Okay.
So he was essentially bait and switching the people that he was offering a home to out of his quote-unquote kindness, but in return wanting everything that they had. So basically selling himself and saying, oh, I have this great place to live, and then taking everything that they had in return.
Sounds like a great dude.
You know, according to a person that prosecutors brought to the stand, he told an ex-girlfriend in 1976, quote, I didn't mean to do it. Didn't mean to do it. So this was one of the things that brought him down in this case, is looking guilty because he told people things that would incriminate him, like what he had told to his ex. He had told multiple people that same, I didn't mean to do it. I didn't mean to kill her.
So he's...
I was just going to see her.
Sorry, you like, broke just... up. He admitted that he did it and said just he didn't mean to, or?
Well, he kept saying, I didn't mean to, I didn't mean to. And then there's conflicting sources saying that he said, I didn't mean to kill her. Or he said, I didn't mean to, I was just going to see her, I didn't mean to. Which the prosecution basically twisted into saying that he was admitting that he... Or the defense, sorry. Admitting that he did it.
Okay.
No. I haven't read the first time. I don't care. Anyway. Like I said, it was one of the things that helped to incriminate him. So there was 3 trials that took place. One of which was a hung jury, and then a conviction was thrown out. Then they finally found him guilty of Cheryl's murder on the 3rd trial. And
was it a mistrial or a hung jury?
The first one was a hung jury, and then the second one was a conviction was thrown out, and then the 3rd one found him guilty.
Okay. Do you know why the first one was a mistrial and the second one was a thrown out conviction?
Mm-mm. And I searched over like 3 or 4 different sources. There wasn't anything
okay
that I could find. The detective who had opened the case, Roy Walton, took the stand and said that when he had spoken to Ferris about Cheryl's death, Ferris had said she was just one of 5 girls that he was screwing at the time.
So, I mean, to me, that could go both ways, though, because, like, if he was sleeping with, like, 5 other girls, then, like, why does he need to sleep with her, too? But also, I mean, proves he's a real great dude, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I can see that going either way.
Yeah, for sure. There's just a lot of back and forth with everything.
That's how most cases are, if you have a good lawyer.
I'm just saying, like, with the testimonies and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So in 2004, almost 3 decades after Cheryl had been found dead, Ferris, who was 55 at the time, was sentenced to life in prison without parole. Throughout the case, there was a lot of discrepancies with the testimonies and the evidence not being gathered correctly, as well as statements being flat out changed over the years as well. So what do you think? Did he do it?
Maybe, but I wouldn't convict him. Like,
who of the three do you think would have done it if it wasn't him? Would you suspect Abbas or Antonio more?
I kind of lean towards it being someone random.
Okay.
Like, someone saw her window open, took advantage of it, like a prowler kind of situation. Because to me, the whole reason that they had said that the suspect was sterile was because they found that she was sexually assaulted, but no semen.
Yep.
I mean, that is weird that they said that in the first place, because, like, she could have been sexually assaulted with, like, an object.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I think that, yeah, I don't know. To me, I think that, I mean, it seems like she had some not so great people in her life, but I mean, just because somebody's a shitty person doesn't mean that they're a murderer. Or even if they are right. a murderer, that they killed this specific person. So, I think that I don't really have a strong opinion about any of them. I mean, they seem like shitty guys, but, you know, it is what it is. I think that for me, the biggest facts in favor of Ferris not doing it are that, you know, his wife said that they woke up around, like, 5 a.m. or whatever, and it's not like he was right next door. He would have had to, like, get ready and then also drive and, like, just have made it there just in time to, you know, kill her and then leave.
I feel like it takes a long time to strangle someone, too.
It does, and
not, like, a long
also,
time, but, like, enough time to where he wouldn't have that much of a time frame.
Right, and also, for me, I think that the prosecution says that, you know, oh, well, they had an argument. Well, there's barely even time for him to kill her and leave, much less have an argument to the point where he wants to kill her.
Yeah. I took from the argument would be on the night that he went to see her, though, like, the night before the wedding.
Oh, and then he comes back?
That's what they were basically painting it as.
I don't know. He sounds like a guy that has, like, rage problems. And I feel like for those type of people, it's generally not, like, a calculated thing. It's like a fly into a rage, can't help it kind of thing. You know, I feel like if he were going to do it, he would have either just done it then, or, you know, he would have, if he did come back and plan it, it wouldn't have literally just have been like, I don't know.
With the time of death type of thing, is that necessarily accurate, or is it just very estimated?
So it really depends.
Because a half hour span is not that long.
It really depends. So there's several things that go into determining time of death. And it's definitely not an exact science. Like, I mean, we've all probably seen an episode of CSI or whatever where the killer, like, turned on the air conditioning to, like, really high to throw off the time of death or whatever. So it really depends, but in a situation like this, where the body was discovered at a certain point, you obviously know it wasn't after then. Usually, if something's discovered that quickly, it's pretty easy, or it's easier to find the time of death. So the main things that they're going to be looking for are rigor mortis, which is, you know, I feel like most people have probably heard of rigor mortis, but it's basically where you do all your muscles, like, constrict and you get, like you can't move a person who is in rigor mortis. Like, they are stuck in, like, one position. And so the rules for, the general rule for rigor mortis is comes for 12, stays for 12, leaves for 12. So for the first 12 hours after death, you are slowly getting more and more rigid. And then for the next 12 hours, you are stuck in rigor mortis. And then after that 12 hours, it slowly goes away over the process of the next 12 hours. Another thing that can be used to tell is stomach contents, but that's a very iffy science because there's not a whole lot of hard evidence on how long it takes to digest food, and like different people's bodies are different. Like, you know, I have IBS and stuff literally like runs through my body as soon as I eat it. But like, whereas like a normal person doesn't go that fast or whatever. So it's just, it varies so much that it's hard to really tell. And that's only really useful if you for sure know the last time somebody ate. The other major thing that's used is, well, body temperature is what you see a lot on TV shows that's used. But body temperature can be affected by so many things. Like I said, you know, killers turning the air conditioning on or whatever to affect it, or turning the heat on to speed up decomposition, or, you know, if it's super hot out or if it's super cold out. But also, you know, now we're starting to find out that the average body temperature isn't as normal as we think. Like, people differ a lot with body temperatures, so that can change that measurement as well. And then the other thing that people look for is going to be, well, sorry, there's a lot of things, but the other major thing is going to be liver mortis, which is basically when you die, your blood stops circulating throughout your body and settles. So if you die on your back and you are allowed to lay there for a while, your blood will pool in your back. So anywhere that is like pushed against a surface is not going to have this, but anywhere else is going to have this like bruising to it almost. And that's just where the blood settles. So this is mostly useful for determining if someone was moved after death. Like if somebody was killed and they laid there on their back for, you know, a little while, and then they were moved and like flipped over onto their stomach, they would have liver mortis, which looks kind of like bruising, on their back, because that's where the blood pooled after they died. And then for bodies, this is usually for bodies that have been dead for longer periods of time, especially like exposed to the elements. They can use insect activity to help determine time of death as well. But I would say the only reason they're able to narrow it down to such a small window is probably due to just how close it was to when she was killed. And it probably had a lot to do with like that the blood was still very wet.
Right.
Sorry, I just went on a whole rant there. Yeah, I took entire classes about this in college, guys.
So, Cheryl's family is highly convinced that Ferris was guilty. The actual people that do the science behind behind discovering, like, who killed someone. They don't believe that he did it. Because the original medical examiner had concluded, like we talked about, that sexually assaulted Cheryl was sterile. So the assistant prosecutor said the problem with that turned out to be that Abbas is not sterile, Antonio is not sterile, and Ferris is not sterile. So even of the pool of suspects that the defense argued could have committed this crime, none of them were sterile.
It just seems weird to me that they're, like, assuming that they're sterile just because there's no semen. I wonder, there must be something else that we don't know, because, like, they could have worn a condom, they could have, like...
They said that someone told them later on that there was, that two detectives had found a large quantity of semen, and what was remarkable was not finding sperm.
Okay.
That's how they ruled it, that the person was sterile, but that came out later.
Okay, yeah, I mean...
they said that...
If there's semen but no sperm, that generally means somebody is sterile, and these dudes aren't.
Right.
So, I mean...
And they were all tested, so... They also questioned the ex-wife's credibility because she told police at one point that it may have all happened in a dream of hers.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I feel bad. I don't want to, like, try to say that she's lying or anything, because I don't necessarily think that she's lying about him being a bad dude. Like, he kind of seems like he is a bad dude. But to me, it seems like she just wants to, like, punish him or, like, get back at him for something. Probably for being horrible to her.
They also found that some of the hair that was coming off the rug was animal hair.
Did they have a dog or a cat or anything?
They didn't say, but, you know, it goes back to your talking about the hair tests and how they're kind of not helpful.
Well, I mean, like, if it's animal hair and, like, they didn't have an animal, then, you know, and, like, you know, one of the suspects did and the other ones didn't, it can help, like, narrow down the search. But, like I said, again, this should, testing, like, hair comparison is generally used to rule people out, not rule people in, unless you're talking about doing a DNA test with it.
Right. And the original pathologist that did the testing is now dead, so.
That usually happens.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm just kind of, like, on the fence about it because I know the area. I know the drive. It's just, like, either he had to leave before she woke up, but even then, like you were saying, he couldn't have known that the roommate wouldn't be there. There's just too many things that, like, don't add up, but I also don't think it was random. It could have been someone from the bar that she met, even.
Yeah, I mean, but, so, I include people that she met, like, at the bar as being random, because she doesn't have a relationship with them, you know? They don't know her habits. Right. The reason I just think it would be, if it were to be someone that knew her, it would really have to be, like, a spur-of-the-moment, like, passion thing, because I don't feel like they would do that when they know, like, oh, her roommate, she has a roommate, like, that could literally come back at any second. And, in fact, will probably be coming home any second, because it's 6 in the goddamn morning.
That also is fishy to me, because, like, why would she be out till 6 in the morning?
I mean, they're, like, 21, 22, right?
Yes, but bars aren't open that late. So I don't know if she was, like, with someone. I wish we had more information about her, too.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know. I never was one to stay out all night, because I am a grandmother and always have been. Got them fun grandma, cool grandma vibes. But, like, I know that, like, in college, a lot of people stay out all night. Like,
you know, they go to the bars, then after the bars, they go to, like, Denny's, or they go to somebody's house and smoke weed, and, or they, you know, she met somebody at the bar and she slept at their house or something like that. Mm-hmm. To me, that doesn't seem super weird, but it does seem weird for me that anybody who, like, knew her and knew that she had a roommate wouldn't be, like, concerned about her roommate coming home. Like, right. They actually took the time, instead of just, like, rage-killing her and then being like, oh, shit, her roommate's gonna be home soon. Like, I gotta go. They, like, took the time to sexually assault her as well.
Yep.
So, I don't know. I think
1,000% he deserves to be in jail, but I don't know if he actually killed her.
Yeah, I really don't think that he did, but I definitely lean a little bit more towards it was somebody that she didn't know well, like somebody she met at the bar, or especially if she's just, like, getting over two breakups, you know?
Yeah, it could have been someone she invited back because they did say that she left early.
Right. So, I don't know. I think that's a possibility. I think, like, a random person, like, climbing into her window is a possibility. Did you by any chance look up at all if there were any active serial killers in the area at that time?
No, because, you know, that sounds terrifying. Because that's where I'm from, but you can go ahead and look that up.
Michigan has a lot of serial killers. Eileen Wuornos is from Michigan. Have you heard of Eileen Wuornos?
Mm-mm.
Oh, I'll have to tell you that story. That's a fucking wild one. But Eileen Wuornos killed men, I think, only. John Norman Collins. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is with murder, it could literally be anybody. Like,
yeah,
people have been murdered for literally nothing. Like,
it's just, you know, I feel like it's still a cold case, unfortunately, and her parents died a while ago, and we'll never get that closure. Her aunt is still alive and stands up for, or, like, was super happy at the trial and was, like, there at every single trial and every single day of the trials.
Yeah, that's always super rough on families of the victim, for sure.
I mean, my, you know, heart and condolences goes out to the family. And, like, it's terrible that it happened, but I don't know. It's one of those things that are still, like, way up in the air and, like, a lot of discrepancies and stuff like that. The only way I can see it happening is that they got the time of death wrong, that he snuck out of the house, did the hour or so drive, and then came back. But we also don't know what time he came back after that. And also the rabbit getting stuck in the wheel well thing is weird to me.
Yeah, I think that's super weird. But I also do, I do want to say that I know I went into a long spiel, but it's definitely possible they got the time of death wrong. Like, to have it narrowed down to, like, a half-hour period is unheard of, practically.
Exactly.
So.
It sounds to me like there was a lot of not good detective work, aside from Roy Walton.
Unfortunately, that seems like literally, like, half the cases, or more than half the cases.
I don't know. I, like, growing up in Saginaw, it's just a different type of vibe for me, because, like, I literally lived in a house. My last house that I lived in Saginaw, two blocks down, a lady was found in a trunk. She had been murdered. And she had been there for at least 2 days, they said.
There was a triple homicide on my college campus my senior year.
Just, like, hearing about murders and stuff like that, it's just, I don't know. I'm desensitized to it, essentially. Because it's so real to me, where I lived. And we always had to play the gunshot or firework game.
Oh, yeah.
And, like,
it's, like, my favorite game.
Living out here in Denver, like, I still, like, when we're in the car and I hear, like, a firework, I still duck. Well, thank you for joining us today on this special episode of True Crime with Millennials, where I decided to take over and present a case. Hopefully it was enjoyable and I didn't sound like I was rambling. You'll have to forgive me because I'm not a big true crime aficionado like my co-host here, but we are looking forward to future episodes. And next episode, Rachel will be taking back over. And it should be, I don't want to say a fun time, but it should be a true crime time. We'll go with that.
All right. Anyway, thanks for hanging out, guys. If you like what you heard, go ahead and give us however many stars you can give us on whatever platform you're listening to. We really would appreciate that. We are super excited to keep bringing you guys content. And let us know what you think.
Oh, yeah. And be sure to check out Science with Millennials, too. It's our other podcast. It's all about science.
Yeah. I'm a true crime nerd, but I'm also a regular nerd because I'm a scientist.
She's a nerd squared.
I'm a nerd, like, to the sixth power. Anyway. I'm getting delirious because I'm sleepy. So I'm going to eat a bunch of cookies okay. And then go to bed.
Sounds like a great time.
All right. Have a good day, guys. Thank you for listening.
Peace out, Girl Scout.